We live in a violent culture. It's a culture that's been violent to black and brown bodies since the days of slavery and the Trail of Tears. It's a day that is violent still to LGBTQ bodies, still to black and brown bodies, to women's bodies, to people's bodies of many different varieties. October is Domestic Violence Awareness Month. We've heard a bit about this already, and it's long been an issue of importance to me. I started in college volunteering at Ann Arbor's Domestic Violence Shelter Safe House, going through that 40 hours of training to be part of that. But it became even more important for me during my last ministry when a woman I knew, Chris Keith, was killed by her estranged husband, and her 11-year-old son, Isaac Miller, was also killed. Chris Keith had been a member of my congregation for many years and had recently moved about 45 minutes away, but was still connected with folks in my church through social media. Chris's story was all too ordinary and yet all too shocking. She had been abused for years and hadn't reached out for help from many of them. She had told me about one incident and said it was the first and only, and she wasn't going to leave her husband over it. She later did leave him and filed for a personal protection order, but then didn't follow through with pressing charges and went back to him, and then left him again. She had had an altercation with him when the police were called, and he voluntarily admitted himself for psychiatric treatment. During that time, his guns were taken away, and when he got out, the police gave the guns back. And within days, Chris and Isaac and Randy, their murderer, were all dead. Her friends, the churches, the police, the mental health system, they all tried in various ways, but it wasn't enough to stop one angry and disturbed man with a gun. This December will be the 5th anniversary of Chris's death, and I think of her still, all the time. All the time. We live in a violent culture, a culture that needs to shift, and one place that shift needs to happen is in our religious institutions, because many religious institutions have internalized a theology of redemptive suffering. I want to explain what I mean by that with a passage by Rebecca Parker, former president of the UU Seminary Starr King School for the Ministry, from her book that she co-authored with Rita Nakashima Brock called Proverbs of Ashes. Rebecca Parker tells the story of a woman coming into her office when she was a minister. The woman's name was Lucia. And she came to Rebecca Parker because she was a woman minister, and she thought she might be able to help. Parker writes, "Come in," I said, and she sat down on the old sofa next to my bookcase with its load of theology texts bending the shelves. She smiled, an expression both warm and sad. "I hadn't talked to anyone about this for a while," she began, the smile fading, the sadness deepening in her eyes. "But I'm worried for my kids now. The problem is my husband. He beats me sometimes. Mostly he's a good man, but sometimes he becomes very angry and hits me. He knocks me down. One time he broke my arm and I had to go to the hospital, but I didn't tell them how my arm got broken." I nodded, and she took a deep breath and went on. "I went to my priest 20 years ago. I've been trying to follow his advice. The priest said I should rejoice in my sufferings because they bring me closer to Jesus. He said Jesus suffered because he loved us, and he said, if you love Jesus, accept the beatings and bear them gladly as Jesus bore the cross. I've tried, but I'm not sure anymore. Tell me, is what the priest told me true?" "I was a liberal Christian," Parker says, "but just that past Sunday, I had preached a sermon on the willingness of love to suffer. I preached that Jesus' life revealed the nature of love and that love would save us. I'd said that love bears all things, never breaks a relationship, keeps ties of connection to others even when they hurt you, places the needs of others before connection for the self. In the stillness of that moment, I could see in Lucia's eyes that she knew the answer to her question just as I did. If I answered her question truthfully, I would have to rethink my theology." The argument that Brock and Parker put forth in Proverbs of Ashes is that much of Christianity, and one could argue much of, by extension, American culture, is based on the idea that suffering is redemptive, that if we suffer, we will be saved, and that if we suffer, we will be better people. And the argument can be advanced that it is women in particular who this message has been given to and who have internalized it. But it is also other oppressed people for whom this message has been given and who have internalized it. Too often, the interpretation of the Bible given to people seeking help from violence is the one we often hear about, that Christ suffered for our sins because we are all sinners, and it was through his suffering that we are saved. We certainly know, too, that Christianity is not the only religion that has been used in negative ways, internalized by both women and men and genderqueer siblings to support violence. As with examples of Christianity, it's a corruption of the religion and not the true faith. But what we must do in our faith is counter these examples and tell of a religion that does not believe you must suffer to be redeemed, that suffering is not necessary to be good, and that God, if you believe in God, does not want us to suffer in any way. The important thing, therefore, is for us to develop our own theology, which should be a theology not that we need to suffer to be close to God, but a theology of sanctuary, where religious institutions, instead of furthering the harm, are the places providing safety, solace, welcome, and love. October is not only Domestic Violence Awareness Month, and of course this is Columbus Day weekend. It's also LGBT History Month, and the month that contains both National Coming Out Day, which is this Thursday, and this year it is the 20th anniversary of the death of Matthew Shepard. We've talked about how women and men who have been abused have often been treated poorly at the hands of the church, encouraged to stay in abusive situations, and encouraged to endure suffering. Gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender, and genderqueer people have also experienced often spiritual violence from institutions that tell them that they are sinful for being who they are or loving who they love, institutions that encourage families to cast out gay and trans family members or force them into oppressive sham therapy designed to cure them of being who they are. My husband was a UU minister for a while, and he would sometimes tell of a member of the first church he served. I think this is actually a conflating of a couple of stories. But he had a member who was a transgender woman and who spoke of the UU church that she attended as having literally, literally saved her life. She was on the verge of taking her life when she learned about our faith, and it saved her. It saved her to know that there was a place where she was welcomed and accepted and loved for who she was. And so I know that our faith saves lives. We have set aside a theology of redemptive suffering and sin and damnation and offered a salvation of love and support. We offer sanctuary. A few years ago, the church I was serving held a forum where LGBTQ youth were speaking. And one talked about how he went into his principal to talk about how he was being bullied. And the principal said, well, suppose you were a kid who dyed his hair pink or green. I forget what color the principal used. You wouldn't expect other kids not to notice and not to react to that, right? In other words, fix yourself, blame the victim. This young man, at least, understands his own value and that it's not okay to pick on him no matter what his sexuality or his hair color, and so he dyed his hair in response, the very color the principal had mentioned. How would we respond if a kid here told us that story? How would we offer sanctuary? Hopefully, we'd do whatever we could, even if it meant dyeing our hair pink or green or blue. October is also Anti-Bullying Month. I've come to believe that bullying is more prevalent than it used to be because we have a culture that encourages, worships, and supports violence. And it's more severe than it used to be. This is not the same thing we dealt with as children. And I don't know how it's handled here in Massachusetts, But from what I've seen other places, is it's not really being dealt with in schools, despite a lot of lip service to the issue. And we continue to see suicides, or bullycides, as they're sometimes called. What's going on is both physical bullying and emotional bullying, and both can be extreme. And the emotional or social bullying can happen 24 hours a day, thanks to the power of social networking. Kids can receive messages of hate and violence on their cell phones, through their email, and on Facebook and Twitter, Snapchat, whatever, all day, all night. And even when they're not receiving them, the messages exist there to be seen over and over and over and over again. How is this an issue for us? We all believe that this is wrong. While it's a moral issue, it's pretty much agreed upon here. I think what makes it our issue is complicated, and I wasn't really sure what the answer to that was until I read this in The Bullied, a book called The Bully, The Bullied, and the Bystander, From Preschool to High School, How Parents and Teachers Can Help Break the Cycle, by Barbara Coloroso. She writes, "Bullying is not about anger. It's not about conflict. It's not about contempt. It's about contempt, a powerful feeling of dislike towards somebody considered to be worthless, inferior, or undeserving of respect. Contempt comes packaged with three apparent psychological advantages that allow kids to harm another human being without feeling empathy, compassion, or shame. A sense of entitlement, the privilege and right to dominate, control, subjugate, and otherwise abuse another human being. An intolerance towards differences. Different equals inferior and thus not worthy of respect. And a liberty to exclude, to bar, to isolate, and to segregate a person not deemed worthy of respect or care. Most bullying is done towards people that the bully feels no compassion for and no identification with. It's done out of that same motivation as domestic violence, as sexual assault, as LGBT harassment, as the harassment and violence we perpetrate against black and brown bodies. It's done so that people can be othered. And these people are chosen as targets of bullying or other violence because they have a weaker social position. So the form of violence changes with the times because the social positions change with the times somewhat. When some of the baby boomers here in the room were young, and those of earlier generations were children, racism was a much bigger factor in our society. And I'm willing to bet that racial bullying made up a bigger percentage of bullying than it does today, although it still exists plenty today. I heard stories of it just this week. And of course, throughout all of our generations, bullying has existed for kids who are physically or mentally disabled. It has existed for girls perceived as the weaker sex. It has existed for anyone considered smaller or weaker or fatter or less popular in some way. And now it particularly exists for gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender youth in a greater way. But it's always existed for them too. So bullying right now is incredibly linked to our civil rights that we are fighting for in so many other areas. It's linked to in our assertion that all people have inherent worth and dignity, are created equal. That's why this is a Unitarian Universalism issue. Violence is about a disregard for and direct opposition to our first principle, the belief in the inherent worth and dignity of all people. Children and adults are taught and learn to hate and to have contempt for others. And there's a deep connection between that hatred and mockery and that which gets spewed by politicians, pundits, and celebrities. And this is where we need a countercultural revolution, a sanctuary revolution. It's time that our society woke up to the real violence in our society and broadcasted the message clearly and effectively that this will not be tolerated by our politicians or in our public squares or anywhere else. But we begin by creating safe space here. And I would certainly, if I had more time, spend more time talking about immigration when we talk about sanctuary, talking about the violence against black people in our culture, from slavery through lynching to imprisonment and disregard for life today. If I had more time, I'd talk more about the violence perpetrated against First Nations people. I'd talk even about geek and gamer culture and the toxic patriarchy in there that's led to things like doxing. And I'd talk about violence against people of different faiths and against atheists and agnostics. This is a sermon without a true solution as it applies to the world. I don't know how to fix any of these issues in the world, bullying or anti-LGBTQ actions or domestic violence and sexual assault. The only solutions I have are for here, for creating sanctuary, because I know it is something we do change here in our own walls. We do model a better way. So what does it mean to provide sanctuary, to be a living sanctuary? It means that we live out our values by being a space that promotes the inherent worth and dignity of people in everything we do. It means we work to make ourselves radically more welcoming, which means to be more inclusive and understanding. There are a list of things we could do, of course, but offering sanctuary is about more. It's about when a parent walks in with a young child, or when a person of a race different than your own walks in these doors, or when a person rolls in on wheels, or a person who is clearly transgender or wearing a hijab, or whatever you perceive the difference between you and them to be, that we bridge the gap, that we show radical welcome, that we show acceptance, and we offer love and a safe space. We offer sanctuary. Changing the dominant culture is about being something else here, something more open, something more diverse, and something more accepting, and it takes work. It takes intention. It takes commitment and recommitment. But we must do it because our faith calls us to it, because the world is hungry for it, because it draws us into deeper and more authentic relationship. As I talked about last week, we have a universal faith, a faith that can embrace and love the whole of humanity and the whole of the world. We have here sanctuary. May we continue to be a sanctuary. May we give sanctuary to each other's. May it be so.